So you go on, stamp your form, Sonny, and stop wasting my time. Because to tell you the truth, I don't give a shit. Welcome to another edition of the Narrative First Podcast, the weekly podcast where story is always king. I am your host, Jim Hull, the voice of Narrative First, and this is episode number 20, the essential ingredients of every complete story. Hello, everyone. Welcome back. Hope you had a great weekend. Last week, we wrapped up our four-week series on the audience appreciations, the story reach, story essence, story tendency, and story nature, which were four story points that, for the most part, I didn't really pay much attention to until about 20 years into the theory, and then I decided it would be time to finally understand them. And now, it turns out, I'm using them all the time. I just, this last weekend, went through a whole bunch of people who have started out with our From Logline to Treatment email course, which is a 9-lesson course that kind of takes you from, you know, if you have a 2-to-3-sentence logline and you want to build it out into a full-page synopsis, maybe a little bit more than a page, and it steps you through different story points that you can layer in on top of your synopsis. And about halfway through the course, there's a point where we actually help you out with it. I don't want to give it away, so if you're interested, I will give links to the course so you can sign up for it if you haven't already, and then you can see what happens about halfway through. So I was fulfilling that part of the course, and I actually used the story essence quite a bit, which was the one that was, you know, whether or not it was overwhelming or surmountable, whether or not those problems that faced the main character or faced the characters, whether or not the problems were dogging the characters or if the characters were dogging the problem, because I wasn't quite sure exactly where the main character of this piece was, you know, whether or not her main character was a doer or a beer, but I knew that it ended in a good judgment. So looking at the actions and events that happened in the story, it was really clear that they were all overwhelming, that the things that were happening to people were really, really overwhelming. And so that left either stop good or start bad. And knowing that it was going to end good, then that made it stop good, which, if you're still following me, that means the main character and overall story through lines are in a companion relationship, which means they're horizontal. And if you haven't turned it off already, and you're still listening to the podcast, that means if her overall story through line was in activities, that means the main character through line would be in situation. So the way I was able, which then means the main character is a doer. So that means the way that I was able to decide whether or not her main character preferred to solve problems externally as a doer or internally as a beer was to look at the problems facing all the characters and seeing that they were very overwhelming, that they weren't something that was easily surmountable, that it was something that persistently dogged all the characters, then I knew it was either going to be stop good or start bad. And knowing that the end of the story was going to end good, then that meant stop good. And knowing that the overall story was in activities, that was really super clear. That put the main character in a situation. So I think these story points, the audience appreciation story points, are super important now, more important than probably, you know, not more important than anything else that I've ever seen before, but I can see how they are a tremendous help and save a huge amount of time. And in fact, right before recording this podcast, I was helping another client in the UK, and same thing, like, I mean, the actions were clearly overwhelming. I mean, clearly overwhelming. He had about 5-10-page treatment already done that he wanted to start working on. And, I mean, it was clear that the story ended bad, so that was a start bad story, which would put the main character in fixed attitude, because again, the overall story was in activities. Most stories are in activities. Sometimes they switch to other places, but for the most part, most people are dealing with overall stories and activities. So that would put his main character in fixed attitude, and I had no idea his main character, in fact, there weren't even any issues. So just because of the sheer nature of how overwhelming everything was that the main character was facing, you'd want to put him in fixed attitude. And so then now we're just basically lining that up with what it was he was trying to say with this story. So if you haven't read those four audience appreciation articles, or you haven't listened to the last four podcasts, you might want to check them out, and hopefully it'll help explain to you what's really going on in a story in a way that you haven't thought of before. Some other follow-up, I have maintained, it's been a week now, blogging every single day, which actually I think is going to help out a lot in developing material and hopefully communicating a lot of ideas in little short bite-sized chunks. I went through the difference between inciting incident and story drivers, and I don't want to get into people who rely on the inciting incident, lots of different interpretations of it, but they're not the same thing as where the story starts. The story driver, that's what Dramatica is mostly interested in, and that's where the inequity in the story begins, particularly in the overall story through line. So I have a little brief blob about that. And then another article I found, which I thought was crazy, somebody who is arguing that Robert the Bruce in Braveheart is the main character of that film. I know what he's getting at. There was a director at DreamWorks who said that Shifu was the main character of Kung Fu Panda because he's the one that changes the most. Dramatica sees main character more as the person whose shoes you stand in because you're trying to get a personal first-person perspective on the problems in a story. So it's really not about who changes. I mean, it's true that the other character changes. It's true that Shifu has the biggest change of heart. And yes, it's true that Robert the Bruce has the biggest change. Not so much change of heart, but more change of paradigm, change of world perspective. But that doesn't necessarily mean they're the main character of the piece. You don't always have to be in the shoes of the person who's having the biggest paradigm shift. In fact, sometimes you can tell great stories like Braveheart without that. And so I went ahead and explained what's really going on in that story from a Dramatica perspective, from the actual parts of a story, which we will get into more this week. And then one of our clients, he had a great example or explanation for how he finally saw inequity. And it's really interesting. People come to Dramatica and they get really into it and they're excited and they work with it. And then a couple months in, they tend to get frustrated and they put it aside. And, you know, this is all hogwash, I don't want anything to do with it. And then a couple months later, they come back and they actually understand it better than they did when they left, even though they haven't really been working on it, I guess. They're still working on it, but subconsciously, and then it finally comes to him. And he had a great explanation for inequity. And when you look at all the story points in a story and you look at everything that's going on, you know, they're labeled domain, concern, issue, problem. And it can be overwhelming. It can be very overwhelming trying to figure out what's the difference between a domain, what's the difference between a concern and an issue and a problem. And I've written about this before, but they're really all the same thing. They're all explaining different levels of magnification in the inequity of a story. And so when you look at a problem, an issue, a concern, or a domain, they're really all just problems. But, you know, the domain is a really large way of looking at a problem. You know, you're like pulling out and looking at the entire thing all at once. And the problem is like the smallest level of magnification. And when we speak of problem in Dramatica, what we're really talking about is an iniquity. See, it's hard to say. But in Dramatica, when we're talking about a problem, what we're really talking about is an inequity, which is an imbalance between things. So, you know, before the story starts, which we'll explain why that's important to understand, but before a story starts, there's equity, there's peace, everything's, you know, okay. And then something happens, that first story driver, not the inciting incident, although I guess sometimes it could be considered the inciting incident, depending on your interpretation of what that word means. But something comes along and disrupts the balance of things and creates an inequity. And then those four through lines are different perspectives or points of view on that inequity. That's why you have four through lines. You don't have four through lines just because that's what we see in stories. It's because that's how you actually tell a story. You know, if you're trying to solve a problem, you want to know all the different ways of solving that problem. You want to see how they solve the problem. That's the overall story through line. You want to see how I solve the problem. That's a main character through line. You want to see how you solve the problem. That's the influence character through line. And then finally, the last one, which is the one most people forget, how do we go about solving the problem? That's the relationship story through line. So that's why you have those four through lines, is because you have different perspectives on how to resolve that inequity, how to resolve what eventually becomes a problem. And so the problem, issue, concern, and domain are different levels of magnification looking at that problem, looking at that initial inequity. But sometimes people don't understand quite what inequity means and what problem means, and you know, they have trouble trying to figure out how to actually write conflict into their story. Some people, it's just natural, it comes to them naturally, but other people or other writers, they're not really sure exactly what an inequity means, and I thought this definition was great. I have this idea now, don't know if it's correct, he's correct, that an inequity is like being between a rock and a hard place, a kind of mini dilemma. So a character has to be kind of damned if he does and damned if he doesn't. That's exactly right. That's why, you know, that's why you have a dilemma, because you're not sure which way to go, because the inequity is there. The inequity is pulling you into two different directions, two different things that can't exist at the same time. So when you write the problem, issue, concern, and domain, just think of writing an inequity at different levels, depending on whether or not you're looking at something small like the problem or something larger like the domain. You'll be able to flesh out your story in a way and make it robust and full of dramatic potential just by writing different varying levels of degrees of an inequity. So once you understand that point, then actually going through and creating the different through lines of your story, it becomes a breeze. So if you can understand this thing about an inequity being something that's between a rock and a hard place, two things that, you know, can't really exist and you're kind of pulled in either way, and you write those at different levels, problem, issue, concern, or domain, for the different through lines, then you'll have a robust and complete story. So be sure to check those out on the blog. It's narrativefirst.com/blog. And again, I'm posting every day now, Saturdays and Sundays, sometimes some inspirational stuff, just to keep the idea of storytelling and story structure, keep it fresh in your mind every single day. Over the weekend, I was able to check out The Little Prince. My kids really loved the film. They thought it was great. They really wanted me to see it. I was excited to see it. I have some friends who I used to work with DreamWorks. They were principals on the film, and so I actually didn't know it at the time when I was watching it, but at the end, when I saw the credits, it was like, oh, I know all these people. And I have to say, it's a beautiful film. The stop motion in it is insanely good. It's beautiful. It's great. And even actually, I mean, that's not to say that the character animation's amazing too. Really subtle, great acting, really just a beautiful, warm film. My problem with it lies in the structure of the story. And I think I figured out what the actual issue is. I haven't written the article yet, so this could possibly change. I'm hoping to do that this week. But essentially, there are two different narratives going on that don't completely wrap up the way that people would expect them to. And I think the problem is that the essential, if you've seen the movie, the essential narrative, the central one, which is all about the main character, I don't even think she has a name in it, the little girl, she's trying to get into a very prestigious school, and the question they ask her is, what do you want to be when you grow up? And the answer is to be essential, right? I guess, you know, a cog in the wheel, you know, be somebody that other people rely on. And the whole point of the story, at least the argument it seems to be making, is that the only thing essential is the relationships that you have with other people. I mean, that's one interpretation of it. The problem is I'm not sure if it quite makes the argument that it originally intended to. I think it gets it to it eventually, but as we'll talk about this week in the essential ingredients of a complete story, I don't think it was constructed in a way where the argument was solid. And then that kind of left it, you know, the last third of the film is a bit all over the place. I was actually surprised right before the podcast, trying to get research on it, that I agreed with Charles Solomon, who's the LA Times animation critic, who I've met several times. And I usually don't tend to agree with his analyses. I mean, he's been writing about animation for decades. And he says, the mother scolds her for wasting time with her new friend. The girl ejects the aviator. He falls ill and is rushed to the hospital. At this point, any semblance of a coherent narrative disappears. And I totally agree with that. So the first half of the film is with the girl and her mother and, you know, figuring out where she fits in. And there's an argument between her and the aviator about getting the idea that there's something more out there. So her mother very much has everything planned out. She's very controlling, and her day-to-day is just all laid out for her. And, you know, she's very sure of what she can expect. Everything's kind of laid out, so she just knows all the stuff. The aviator's argument is that, you know, you don't really know what's going to happen, but then that's okay. And I think the idea was arguing, you know, when someone dies, are you sure that you'll ever see them again? You know, the aviator has a very positive, well, you never know what can happen. And she's very set on the certainty aspect. You know, if I had to look into the Dramatica table of story elements, I would probably say she sits on certainty and the aviator sits on potentiality. And in fact, there's a really great scene between the two of them where they argue these two points. And that is actually, you know, the crux or the crucial elements of the story, of that first story, which, interestingly enough, has a time lock on it that eventually is forgotten. But my point is this. The overall story of that first narrative drive between, you know, potentiality and certainty, the overall story of that is getting the girl to get the idea that there is something more out there than what she's been told, to conceive of something essential that isn't, in fact, being essential. And that creates a concern of conceiving, which just so happens is where a lot of French films, and this is based on a French story, this is where a lot of those kinds of films, they sit in the lower right-hand part of the Dramatica table of story elements. And it's just really strange for most people to deal with a psychology story, that's where it ends up, an overall psychology story, because the conflict isn't about people trying to kill one another or people trying to take over the world, which is what, unfortunately, a lot of animation is about. What's at stake? World domination. It's always world domination. I want the world. The world is mine! In a psychology story, it's a little more sophisticated, you know? Ratatouille is like that. You know, anyone can cook. So the overall story idea, our overall story through line in Ratatouille is about anyone can cook and conceiving of that idea that, yeah, anyone can cook. And that's handled really well, the overall story through line here. Here, I think it's handled well for about 3/4 of it. And then once the aviator falls ill and ends up in the hospital, they kind of lose that storyline. And then, you know, with him gone, they have to come in with a different influence character. And he has a completely different set of problems. You know, that story is about basically Peter Pan growing up, where he's forgotten his childhood, and she can't forget her childhood, and so that argument is going on, and that's a different story, but, you know, it's just starting here. I mean, there were bits and pieces of it within the first 3/4, but now it's just starting up here at the end, and feels like a completely different story. It's a lot more activity, overall story through line, with the evil businessman trying to destroy all the stars in the world, and so that storyline ends up wrapping up, and then we come back to the aviator, and you know, she finally has her change of heart, and she allows herself to be tamed by him. So, I think this could have been solved, it could have been fixed, and it wouldn't feel like it lost all sense of narrative drive, as Charles Solomon says, if somehow you had been able to put off the aviator's whole accent, all that stuff, till after you resolved the issues with the little prince and him forgetting. So in other words, instead of basically ending the first story and then starting a new sub-story, you maintain that first story and then kind of weave in that sub-story in the middle of it and wrap that up before coming back to the overall story, the bigger picture story, and resolving that. Because we really didn't even get to see what happened with her trying to get into school. Not like that's an essential part of the story, but it is. That's where the satisfaction of it is. That's where the story outcome is. Yes, she did finally conceive of that, but we didn't get to see how that played out with the school. I mean, we do get to see her up on top with her mother, and it's very happy, and it's very heartwarming. It's very fulfilling. That part is really well done. But the satisfaction quotient of it, that's where Charles Solomon, that's where he feels like it lacks the narrative drive, because the logistical aspects of it are kind of just lost, and it's just kind of thrown away in sort of an absurdist way. Not that it's an absurd emotional judgment, but just kind of willy-nilly, no more logical part of the story, that's all gone. And because you're leaving one story and then essentially starting a second one, you get the feeling that the drive of the story, the narrative drive of it, has completely gone. So one way to fix it would have been to weave in the sub-story of, you know, remembering your childhood and remembering the rose, all that stuff with the little prince, have that happen before everything that happened with the aviator. That, I think, would have helped keep the semblance of a complete and coherent story. I mean, it's still a beautiful film. It's still worth seeing, but I would be surprised if you didn't feel the same way towards the end, where you're kind of looking around thinking, okay, where is this story going? I'm not sure. There was a time lock here, but I guess we're not even, and it was a really strong time lock. You know, it's not like the end of Star Wars where it's just like the last 10 minutes. This is from the very beginning. We've got, I think it was 2 weeks, 60 days? I forget how long it was. But we've got a certain amount of time until school starts, and then we just count down the time every act. But then that last act, it's completely forgot. And so then you're, you know, the story limit of a story, that sets the limit for the story. And so once you get rid of that and you lose it, then you have no idea the scope of the story. You have no idea when it's going to come to an end, which, strangely enough, is the same problem with Ratatouille. You know, if you're going to set that up, audiences are going to expect that. So I would definitely suggest seeing it, but I would be really surprised if you saw it and didn't feel some level of dissatisfaction. And not that you wouldn't feel fulfilled, which is the judgment of a story, rather the outcome of the story, whether or not you feel that you were satisfied with the way everything turned out logistically. From the audience appreciations, and we're going to get back to basics. We're going to talk about the essential ingredients of every complete story. Now, if you're familiar with Dramatica and you've been using it for years and years, you're going to know the answer to all these questions. It's going to make complete sense to you. But maybe, perhaps, there'll be some new way of looking at it, some new insight that will cause you to see it in a completely different light. Like I talked about last week, and lately, Chris Huntley, the co-creator of the Dramatica Theory of Story, lately has been pushing this idea that the influence character represents the path not taken for the main character. You know, the main character builds up their justifications, they have their backstory, and the influence character went about things a different way. And when they come back, you know, into the main character's life, or if they've been there all the time and they just start poking at them with it, they're showing, you know, well, if you had done things differently, this is what would have happened to you. And that's the alternative perspective, a different way of approaching the problem. And I'd never thought of it that way in the last two decades. And so hearing it like that, you know, you begin to see stories in a different light and it increases your understanding. So even if you already know all the answers to these questions and you've heard them a million times, just humor me and listen in and see if there isn't something new that you can learn from it. So for those who don't know, Dramatica is based on the idea that a complete story is an analogy of a single human mind trying to solve a problem. Now that's a huge wordful, but it basically means that character, plot, theme, and genre, all that stuff, are all just components of a story mind at work. You know, stories aren't about three-dimensional people, and they're not about complicating events of rising tension or whatever it is that you might have read before. What they really are analogies to what goes on in that big gray mass behind your eyes. And it all started around a campfire. So if you think back to caveman days, and you think of Ugga and Orga, whatever caveman name you can come up with, when they would return from their day's adventure and tell everybody what they saw out there, they would warn them, you know, watch out for this animal over here, and you'll find food around this corner. And they wanted to tell everybody what was going on out on their adventures. They'd tell them about the danger, the excitement, the food, everything. But eventually they wanted to extend their reach beyond the campfire and tell other cave people and other communities what they had discovered. So really, they were like the first bloggers. They didn't have access to Twitter or Facebook or CMSs where they could post about story structure and story analysis. So they lacked the means to back up their stories and answer any questions posed to them. You know, you could figure if you're telling a story around a campfire, and somebody goes, well, wait a second, what about this? You know, you could easily answer them back and fill in any holes. But when it comes to moving that story outside of your own control and letting other people tell that story, you got to make sure you cover all the bases within the storytelling. You got to make sure you cover all parts of the argument. Otherwise, you know, some troll could say, hey, what if the saber-toothed tiger didn't come after me? Or what if I climbed that tree and didn't find a berry? So they needed a way to counteract these trolls, and they needed to develop a mind for the others to inhabit. So they created a story mind. Ugga and Orga needed a way to counteract these trolls of story. They needed to develop a mind for others to inhabit. So over centuries, this matured into the story mind. It's a self-contained model of the human mind at work. Now, along the years, some tried to define this model the way that they saw it. So Aristotle, Joseph Campbell, Sid Field, Christopher Vogler, Blake Snyder. With each generation came greater understanding, yet somehow it was all still incomplete. Fortunately, the hundreds and thousands of years between Ugga and Snyder hid the fact that stories were really just a way to communicate the most appropriate way to solve a problem. Without that reality in mind, any attempt to define story naturally got lost in subjective interpretations of who the characters were and whatever spiritual or transformational journey they appeared to be on. And in their attempt to define who, what, and how, They completely forgot why. The true nature of story, it seemed, would lie buried beneath the oceans of time for all eternity. Until Dramatica. So way back in 1993, Chris Huntley and Melanie Ann Phillips, the modern-day versions of Uga and Orga, released the Dramatica theory of story. And instead of looking for patterns and seeing cultural trends and seeing, you know, looking at stories, they actually looked at psychology to develop a model of psychology of story. And what they were trying to do is trying to find the ingredients of story from the other side, from the author's perspective. All these other paradigms that you're familiar with or that you may have learned in school work to explain the experience of either hearing or listening to a story. But if you think about it, Uga and Orga weren't interested in the experience. They were more concerned with the process, like how effectively could they communicate their message. And those first storytellers realized that you can't serve up a delicious meal by simply taste testing your favorite dishes. You need to know the ingredients first. And that's what this week's podcast is all about. So if you have a chance, I'll leave a link in the show notes. You'll see a link to the Dramatica table of story elements at rest. That's that big, complicated grid of tons of different story elements in there. You'll see situation, activities, psychology, fixed attitudes, but you'll see all of them are perfectly at peace. Self-interest sits across from morality, pursuit from avoid, the past from the present, and even inequity from equity. Every single last diagonal relationship within the model tells of a perfect balance, which is great, but with no inequity, there's no story. In order to make this model messy and create the potential for a story, someone needs to get in there and twist it all up until the theoretical rubber bands that tie everything together begin to strain under the pressure, until they verge on the very brink of snapping. Someone needs to get in there and start making choices to wind this model up to the point where one tap will send it all unraveling, spinning over and over again until it returns to that state of peace. And that someone is you. So if you want to get your hands dirty writing a story, you're going to have to answer a few questions, 8 of them to be exact. These 8 dynamic questions set the amount of pressure applied at various locations within the model. If you want a different kind of story, you need to twist it up a different kind of way. Now, Dramatica labels these 8 questions dynamic because they claim responsibility for twisting and turning the model at rest into a fully realized, packed full of potential story mind. Other questions and story points concern themselves more with the structural aspects of the narrative, you know, kind of the fixed aspects of it. These fellows focus on movement between the dramatic structures. When developing a story, authors need to know the answers to these questions. If they don't, their story will likely sputter out and crash 3 feet in front of them like the rubber band airplanes they didn't take the time to wind up properly. You need to take the time to wind up your airplane. So the first story points we'll get into this week. I was going to do all 8, but as it turns out, it's got a little robust, and I felt like we should spread it out over a couple of weeks. So this week we're going to talk about character arc, which is usually the thing that most people are comfortable with. And the first 2 dynamic questions work together to form what most people think of as character arc. This would be the main character resolve and the main character growth. So the reason why people are so into character arc isn't because it helps explain the journey they're on, in so much as it explains the relationship between the main character through line and the overall story through line. You know, like I was speaking before in the work that I had done with clients, you know, finding out where the overall story is and then finding out where the main character is in relationship to that overall story is really important to the structural narrative. It's really important because it helps explain how everything relates together. And the reason for this is not because that's what Dramatica needs in order to accurately predict your story. I mean, it is, but that's not why they put it together. It's based on the idea that every problem is really seen as an inequity between the way we see the world and the way the world truly is. That's where you get the inequity, is between you and the world. The main character's through line versus the overall story through line. And understanding where those 2 come together and which one lies closer to the truth determines how to jumble up the rest of the story mind. So it's not just this like arbitrary thing that you just need to have. Well, he's got wants and needs and he's got this character arc. No, there's actually a specific reason why you have a character arc structurally and dynamically within a narrative. The main character resolve simply asks, at the end of the story, does the main character remain steadfast in their worldview or did they change and adopt the influence character's point of view? And for those of you who don't know, the influence character represents the alternative approach towards solving problems in a story, like I was speaking before, that path not taken. Usually it's a mentor, or it could be a father, brother, lover, whoever's there to challenge the main character's way of seeing things and show him that path not taken. That's the influence character. The other half of character arc, the main character growth, defines the direction of that growth. Does the main character grow by losing a trait or by gaining a trait? Do they stop doing something or start doing something? So with main character resolve, your choices are changed or steadfast. In the current version of the software, it says change or steadfast. And I really like the idea of changed because it's really about, everybody understands that characters change and grow, but they mean grow, but they use the word change. And I feel like there's sometimes some confusion with change in there. If it was changed, I think it would be more accurate because you're essentially just talking about the end of the story. Was it changed? Was their resolve changed? Or was it steadfast? And I think that would kind of clear things up. Maybe someday. And the exact application, you know, how you use the growth depends on the resolve. Like, it kind of slightly changes with the resolve. If with a changed story, the changed main character, it works like you would think. You know, they change by either letting go of something or by gaining something new that they didn't have before. In a steadfast main character, it's not so much them gaining or losing a trait as it is they're holding out for something to start outside of them or holding out for something to stop outside of them. So it's still their growth. It's not talking about somebody else's growth. It's still their growth, but it's in relation to what they're holding out for something to happen. So when you put these all together, that's the first way that the model starts to get wound up. And we'll look at these, and they create four very different kinds of stories. So with the changed stop story, so that's one where the main character changes the way they see the world by adopting the influence character's point of view. They may kick and scream the entire way, but by the end, they'll change their resolve by dropping some trait or character flaw. So if you think of Neo, he stops doubting himself in the Matrix. He gets rid of that doubt and starts thinking more like Morpheus and Trinity. Okay, that would be a character who's got a changed resolve and a growth of stop. If you think of Tony Curtis in Some Like It Hot, Joe, he stops living the life of a distrustful, dishonest, irresponsible ladies' man. And also if you look at Sully in Monsters, Inc., he stops scaring the crap out of little kids. You know, they found that in change stories, they realized that they were the problem in the story, and they were able to stop or get rid of that trait that was causing the problems and be able to change their resolve to a different way of seeing things. Now, the flip side of that are the changed start stories. In these narratives, authors tell stories of main characters who change the way they see things by adding something to their lives. They still adopt the influence character's perspective, but they do it by starting something new. So Red starts standing up for himself in The Shawshank Redemption. You know, so you go on, stamp your form, Sonny, and stop wasting my time. Because to tell you the truth, I don't care. Matt King, George Clooney character in The Descendants, he starts defending his family. And Oscar engages in a little bit of the unspeakable, gives into a little bit of temptation, and let the right one in. So those are the changed characters. They change their resolve by either dropping a trait or adding a trait. And now we'll look at the other half, which are the steadfast characters. So in contrast to the changed characters, these characters stand up for themselves and end up changing the way the influence character sees the world. And this is a really, really important thing to understand. It's something that I had to suffer for 15 years at DreamWorks. If the main character remains steadfast, then the influence character has to change their resolve. So let me say that again. If the main character remains steadfast, then the influence character has to change their resolve. If they don't, or if both change, then the author has communicated nothing. There is a huge period at DreamWorks in between Shrek 2 and How to Train Your Dragon where both main character and influence character changed, and it was very frustrating. When you have both characters change, you're not really arguing a position. So if you think back to Uga and Orga, they were trying to communicate the most appropriate way to solve problems in their community. In order to combat all those trolls in the cave down by the river, they had to match up one way of solving problems against another. By showing the result of one approach, you know, basically winning out over the other, they were able to effectively argue and convince those idiots how best to lead their lives. And the process hasn't changed today. Authors can communicate the best way to solve problems by showing the wrong way first or by showing the right way first. Either way, it doesn't matter as long as one side effectively wins over the other, as long as one changes to the other's point of view. So this is the first thing you have to discover in any story: who your main character is, what their perspective on life is, and who your influence character is, what their perspective on life is, and which one adopts the other's perspective. That's the essential ingredient of any story, of any narrative. So the main characters of the following stories, they remain steadfast by holding out for something or someone to stop and change to the main character's point of view. So Hiccup holds out for his father and the other Vikings to stop killing dragons and How to Train Your Dragon, and his dad eventually gets the point. Captain Kirk holds out for Spock and the rest of his teammates to stop running hog wild throughout the galaxy in Star Trek, and the Vulcan eventually stops flying off the handle all the time. And lastly, Marty McFly holds out for his dad and everyone else to stop running away from trouble in Back to the Future, resulting in George finally balling up his fist and taking that swing. Even with these short explanations, one can begin to see the difference in dynamic tension set by these two essential ingredients of story. The difference lies in the method by which the story mind winds up and by the potentials that wind-up ultimately creates. You can see how these stories feel very different than the change stories, and that all has to do with which parts of the model you wind up first. So there's actually a very specific reason as to why some stories are about main characters changing to an alternate point of view, and why some stories are about the main character getting someone else to change to their point of view. And finally, we look to main characters who hold out in the desperate hope that something will start. As talked about before in Ratatouille, Remy holds out for everyone to start seeing him as a real chef in Ratatouille. Ray Kinsella buys into the whole "if you build it, he will come" idea, dutifully holding out for that moment to start in Field of Dreams. And juror number 8, that's Henry Fonda, holds out for the other jurors to start coming to the realization that this kid is innocent in 12 Angry Men. Again, very different dynamics at work in these kinds of stories. The main character in these stories represents the right way to solve problems, and it's just a matter of holding out in the hopes that the other side will eventually see the light. By remaining steadfast and digging their heels in, they eventually manage to convince the other side to change and adopt their point of view. Already, one can see the variety of dishes available with only these two ingredients. Essential as they are to the eventual taste and experience of the meal, the main character resolve and main character growth paint an incomplete picture. In order to completely wrap up the story mind into something full of dramatic potential, 6 more questions must be answered. So in the coming weeks, I'll discuss these essential questions that Ugga and Orga knew instinctively centuries ago, but for some reason were lost over the years. By understanding the true purpose of telling a story and appreciating the methods by which the potential of a story manifests, authors everywhere should be well equipped to create the most savory and flavorful meals. And that should keep the trolls quiet. Thank you again for joining us this week. Hope you learned something about main character resolve and main character growth, something that you can apply to your story right away. If you have any questions, please visit narrativefirst.com/podcast. Click on the microphone button and leave your question, and I'll answer it as best I can. Have a great week of writing, and we will see you next week.